Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back, and it is now or never, and that debt is fraud, and we need to continue to learn, pray, and act, and we're all about holding. The whole point, folks, you know, maybe we need to start praying on the strength of actually challenging our public servants, because there's not a lot of people that are even doing that. I mean, there's people complaining, and they're allowing the parties to obviate and create, you know, these us against them type of scenarios when it's about holding everybody accountable. Because when we really look at who's violating the Constitution, there's nobody there that's blameless. Nobody. And I think that once we start helping people understand, then we're going to get better behavior out of some of these decent people that it's about time. You know, I'm so glad you're doing this. Anyway, it's all about accountability. So welcome back, both Sean and Tammy. We've got Tammy today with us, and welcome back, Tammy.
Thank you.
And so we didn't get into the seventh, we wrapped up on the Seventh Amendment and continued on the trial by jury and jury trial, but we didn't get into the Eighth Amendment. And I believe that this is actually one of those amendments that really helps, because we're not following this amendment. But let's read it first. And so, Sean, why don't you go ahead and pick up the Eighth Amendment here.
Amendment 8, excessive bail shall not be required, nor excessive fines imposed, nor cruel and unusual punishments inflicted.
Okay. So when you look at that, what does that mean that it says excessive bail shall not be required? What is excessive bail for you? Do you have a dollar figure? Or
you couldn't afford to pay it.
Okay, so let's look at it this way, because if I asked 100 people and I went through different communities, from gated communities to projects, what excessive, do you think we would have an agreement on what excessive bail would equate to?
Absolutely not.
But I think we would have an agreement. I think we could easily obtain an agreement on what would be excessive bail. I believe excessive bail is something that you can't come up with, you can't obtain within a year's time. In other words, your year's salary, the job that you have, that would not pay, you know, you're providing for you and your family, that bail would be excessive if it took one whole year away from you. You would not be able to provide to feed your family, to put, you know, roof over their head. Does that make sense?
I have to disagree, because I think the people that are on the lower end of the income scale would say that, let's say for a petty crime, your bail's $500. Well, if you have $0, then $500 is excessive. If you live in a gated community and you have the same crime, then $500 isn't excessive.
Okay, I understand that. And I think we agree. I believe that it should be proportional. Now, let's be clear here. If your livelihood is off of the government, in other words, you're not doing anything for yourself, you're just a leech, then I think that you should go, because that should actually have its own class, because you're not really doing what you need to do to provide for yourself. You've just said, take care of me, right?
Right. You're basically giving yourself up to be a ward of the state.
There you go. So as far as I'm concerned, I think that, you know, the bail or what have you would need to be more severe not because they deserve it, because they're not trying to actually be anything different than a burden. And if they want to commit crime, then because I believe that and there's actually been some comments I've seen in social media that says if you're on SNAP and you're not getting your SNAP payment right now because nobody's getting paid because of the shutdown, and you get caught stealing food, then you should be, you know, you should lose your SNAP entitlement. I'm just saying that that's
innocent people that suffer because of that. And I don't think it's fair to the children of those people to suffer. It's a hard thing.
Yeah. So do you teach your children?
We all know that the government shouldn't be giving out food stamps.
There you go.
But when you have children that you have to feed, and that's what you use to feed them, and the children have no say in you leeching off of the government, you know, you kind of have a dilemma.
Yeah, so what did they do before government programs?
The church.
There you go. So right now, how many people are going to their pastors, their churches, and saying, can you give me assistance? Can you help me? Well,
I know in my community we have very strong churches for that kind of community service. So they're already planning for that to happen.
Okay.
But I understand what you're talking about. The problem is that nowadays we have more people on government assistance than we have in the churches.
And what you're basically saying, because this actually points to how insidious and how evil and how destructive, you know, this is. Yes. And as a matter of fact, this is how the Democrats are getting away with playing this, because we've been the nice benefactor for you. You've benefited from becoming our tool. And if you want to continue benefiting, then you need to get out and start protesting and burning down things, because that's how the left works. So, but the reality is, I believe that that's a different set of people, and we need to completely dump all of those people out of government. But that's a separate process, because bottom line, if it's about adhering to the Constitution, state Constitution, now I've not seen any state Constitution where they have stated they've empowered their government to take from those who have and give to those who have not. In other words, a redistribution of wealth. I've never seen that in any Constitution. So how is it that we've got this system that is doing this? Because the federal government came along with money a long time ago and started actually playing these games. And guess what? They were rewarding women who had children in their homes without a father. In other words, the more kids you had, the more money you made. So you can't tell me that this is something that the people wanted. This was something that was handed out by the government, and over the half a century now, they have manipulated us way too many people have gamed the system, because the system created these things to allow you to game them on. Everybody saw it. Everybody knew that it was wrong. As a matter of fact, Ward Connerly, a man I met, I interviewed him in Spokane on my radio show. Great man. He was appointed by Reagan to be the regent of the California universities. And his struggle for his book was called My Struggle for Equal. And he talks about how when he was a child and he had to move, and I think it was Louisiana, when they finally packed up and moved, and the preachers would be coming into the homes with social workers trying to get people to start taking government welfare. And no self-respecting black person was going to do that, because they knew that this would become a dependency. They looked at this as a very bad thing. And so he recounts how his whole family was, you know, had this one paradigm. They moved to California, and years later, after he's graduated from high school, comes home to visit,
And there in his living room is a preacher trying to get his grandma to actually enroll in the welfare state of California. And all talking about the benefits. And Ward Connolly just, you know, interrupted and said, "What the heck you think you're doing?" So there, you know, everybody has to take ownership on this. The federal government should never have actually ever came down. That door should never have been opened. And the states should have stopped them as soon as they started doing this. There's enough blame to go around for everybody. But let's put that class of people who are basically government shills, tools, dependents under the government. That's a different class. They're going to be committing crimes and so forth. And they should actually have to pay for their crime. But when we look at the Constitution, this Constitution was not deemed as, or I should say, this amendment was not deemed that there would be ever be dependence on government, that all people would be providing for themselves. So I believe that we do have two classes. Now let's talk about the difference between a young man who's got a child on the way. He may be 19 years of age. He's got a trade. Maybe he's a butcher. Maybe he's, you know, working on his journeymanship to be a butcher. It's a trade. We're talking trade, not college. So in other words, he's making decent money. He's working as an apprentice as a plumber. He's making $20, $30 an hour. But he's not rich. And he's paying rent and everything else. And let's say he decides to, you know, because he just turned 21. I'm just going to use one scenario because I like the scenario. He just turns 21 and he goes out and celebrates with his friends after work and then has a little bit to drink and, you know, and then drives home under the influence. He gets pulled over and he gets today based on bail and everything else for driving behind the wheel drunk. Instantly, he has this huge legal fine that's placed upon him. Do you know what the charge would be? It's different in every state, but I'm going to guess, I think the national average is around $50,000 fine, right? $50,000 fine. So how hard would that be? Would that be an excessive bail for what he did?
I would say yes.
Now, let's take the young baseball star, football star, what have you, maybe about the same age, 20, 21, you know, and, you know, active. They may be about 24, 25, so they may supposedly be more mature. But they get hit with the exact same fine, $50,000.
Yeah.
Is that excessive for them?
I don't know. I know what's ridiculous is that if it's some kind of state representative or a public servant, they're going to get a way less fine and probably won't even go to jail.
Yes. Okay. So I'm with you there. But our system should be blind. Justice for it to be right is blind. And so when we create a system that is absolutely, you know, got the blinders off and is looking and saying, you know, if you're in this class, if you're in middle class or lower middle class, then you are going to suffer if you make a mistake. But if you're in upper classes, then it's no big deal. It's just nothing. You just pay the fine. Now, you know as well as I do.
Maybe it should be a certain percentage then.
That's exactly where I'm going, because I believe that when you look, because we don't want to make a drunk driver, because the consequences could be very severe, right? Very severe if he actually had an accident and hurt somebody, killed somebody. But he didn't. In this particular case, it was just he got caught behind the wheel through a sobriety checkpoint, what have you. Regardless of how he got caught, he didn't hit anybody. He just got caught. So now we, you know, have this process that is going to lay this fine because he's going to be arrested. And if he can't pay the fine, he actually has to go to a person who's conducting usury. Do you know what I mean by a bail bondsman and what they do? basically they get you to pay a little bit and then they charge you outrageous fees so that, you know, you're strapped because you have to get out and you actually have to, you know, pay for, you know, the food for your family and so forth. Right? You still, this kid still has his family. So the consequences are really being just heavy on this one kid for making this mistake. And this other kid at about, let's just say they're the same age. They both made the same mistake. And it is not excessive for one, but it is heavily excessive for the other. And I believe that the best way to do this is for everybody to start saying, what should it be? Should it be 50% of your salary? You know, okay, then 50% of this kid's salary, it may be a $15,000 fee, fine, what have you. And for the baseball player, it may be $6
million. Right.
But it's equally, you know, just, or I should say, it's not excessive. It's a $6 million is not excessive to the kid that's bringing $12 million in. And, you know, the kid that's bringing in $40 million or $20 million or whatever that half of their salary is. Or however you want to mitigate it. But I believe that this has to be fixed. Because right now, we don't have a blind system. We have a blind system that has no regard for certain classes of people. Or it's a much heavier burden for those people in society that are just trying to start off. The people that need that help, and they're going to make mistakes. They're going to make mistakes. Should we destroy their whole livelihood and the put them on a course of life that's going to be, you know, just trying to catch up the rest of their life? So I'm looking at what really needs to happen, and I'd like to see how states played this game. Because I'd like to see states actually admit that the judicial system, the way the judges and everybody did this as a flat rate and everything else, nobody batted an eye. And this is why this has been basically integrated into every state, as far as I know. But I'd love to see these types of standards change to where we actually have an equal or a fair level of harm for the crime we committed, right? And so we can't be destroying people and taking their property and taking everything. This cruel and unusual punishment in some states, and I believe Wyoming is one of them, where they'll confiscate a lot of your property. Is that not correct?
Mm-hmm. That's terrible.
Okay, so the way I see this is, as we're looking at, you know, what a state should be able to do, you know, I think that, one, we already know the Fifth Amendment doesn't allow them to take any of your property away from you without just compensation. It doesn't say there that, oh, well, they can take property away from you if you committed a crime. Is that in the Fifth Amendment?
No, sir.
No, it basically says that no property can be taken from a person for public use, because that's what they do when the police take your car because you drove too fast, and they say, we're impounding and taking your car from you. We're going to confiscate your car because you just drove too fast, and now it's ours. Well, you can't do that without giving him just compensation. And guess what? The value of controversy is going to be over $20, so they're going to actually have a right to a trial by jury, and they would never get away with this kind of crap if we were following the Constitution. I'm not trying to make law enforcement this evil entity, but they've been manipulated and concocted into a form that becomes very parasitical. It becomes a predator because they start taking and taking and taking when the Constitution protects us from those types of things. So when we look at the cruel and unusual punishments, when you actually devastate a person, when you're looking, you know, down the road and going, wow, you know, that really hurt, then I honestly believe that there's a problem with the system itself. Do you not agree? Because I don't think the intent here, I don't think the intent here was to actually allow, you know, this disparity, you know, and not recognizing the individual. As a matter of fact, when we look at every case that the courts are supposed to hear, they're supposed to hear every case based on law and fact. you know, and take in all of the circumstances regarding the person and everything else. But instead, we've all been just cast into this, okay, you're part of the society, the fees are going to be the same for everybody. And to me, that is not a blind justice system. I believe that the blind justice system actually ensures that, you know, what you want for your defense, you can have. And, you know, instead of keeping people, you know, into these, I'll just say, into these situations that are going to destroy them. When we're talking about, and this is literally based on criminal laws and violations and so forth. It also, like, you know, well, no, this is all criminal, because whether it's, you know, fraud, or whether it is embezzlement, or whether it is, you know, a physical crime, traffic, what have you. If you're going to associate fees and fines and so forth, then as far as I'm concerned, they need to be done in a way where you feel the same pain that the next guy will feel. Or gal. That, you know, and that's kind of hard to do with some people that have such a level of opulence, you know what I mean? So that's that's another challenge for the state to figure out, what do you do with Warren Buffett? What do you do with the Bill Gates that, you know, they can just buy the whole state? Well, then, you know, you actually have to take into consideration probably their assets as well. Because most of those guys just hide their income and they just leave it in assets, all property and so forth. And so you don't see any income. Anyway, I think that that right there would probably cause another category, when you have those who are completely dependent and those who have left our society to become monarchs over us, which we really have to watch those people, because they're far more evil than those people who have chosen to become dependents. So anyway.
I was just going to comment while you were talking about bail on what they're doing in some of the big cities, the blue-run cities, where these Soros prosecutors are trying to institute cashless bail for violent crimes.
Yep.
So meanwhile, while you had the oligarchs and the self-proclaimed monarchy, the rich elites, that, you know, they have no, they don't, the law doesn't apply to them. They're facilitating putting violent criminals back on the street.
Yep.
And while the middle class is the only one that's answering to any kind of justice.
Yeah, they're the only ones. It's like when you look at those people who tore through the United States in 2020 and damaged all of these different cities, burnt down buildings, nobody, hardly anybody went to jail. But boy, did the gloves come off with the January 6th fiasco. Right? Yeah.
Actually, the person who was running for president was one of the ones who was funneling money to a bail fund for those people who were burning down cities.
Oh, yeah. I wouldn't doubt that at all. I would not doubt that at all. But I think that, you know, we need to be more mature in looking at what we need to do. And actually, specifically, there are certain things that are absolute problems that really require attention, because I don't believe our rights are necessarily being properly. I think the Eighth Amendment is clear, that they basically wrote it in a simple way to say no excessive fines or punishments should ever be imposed. But we've been doing this left and right and hurting good people, because technically the way our bail and our fine system has been created, it does actually create excessive and cruel punishments for certain people, because they don't have the level of affluence that other people in the upper classes do. And I don't think that the way they wrote this, I cannot believe that their intent was, yeah, it's, you know, This was all designed for benefiting those who had more than those who had less. Anyway, we'll be right back after this break. Thank you so much.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. All right, so we've just dove into the Eighth Amendment, and what I was trying to say going into break is I think it's incumbent upon a civil society as well as an enlightened society to try to create a system of justice that absolutely, I think, absolutely recognizes each of the individuals that come in. That nobody walks into that court that is at the equal status of either the judge, the governor, or anything like that, but they should have at least the equal access to justice as well as equal access to whatever the fines and punishments would be, if that makes sense. Now, I believe that when we look at the time that they add on to, let me ask you this. When we look at career criminals, many states have actually gone down the path. I hope somebody's okay. When we look at criminals that go down the path of career criminals, states have actually invoked three strike laws. What is your concept on that? Do you think that that's excessive?
What was it again?
So when criminals go down the path of, you know, repeating offenses, there are states that have actually created three strike laws. In other words, you do three type of felonies, you're going to jail for a long time.
I would think that's in violation of equal justice.
Well, so equal justice under the law means that they're creating a law that says, you know, if you've committed three crimes, three serious crimes, doesn't matter how long the separations between them are, right? But if you commit three felonies, then you can, you know, we're going to send you away for, you know, 10 years or for a long period of time, period. You're not getting out. It's not that I don't agree with you. What do you think, Tammy?
I mean, if you keep doing the crime over again, I think there needs to be a more severe punishment.
Yes, and so it all depends on the type of crimes and so forth, but let's look at it this way. I honestly believe that because we're just covering this with the way they've done this over felonies and so forth. I believe that America has been turned its back on understanding the importance of the rule of law and a republican form of government. Now, I know we've gone through this in a very painstaking way because I remember, Sean, you've asked, and you can continue to ask, what is a republican form of government? And, you know, our representation, being the sovereigns, is one part of that. The other part of that is the rule of law, which means the law is our king. We're all to be held equally accountable to the law. Now, the law basically dictates, because we've kind of covered the oath of a citizen, because we've talked about the oath of office, oath of citizen, that it is incumbent upon every citizen of this nation to do one thing, We have to support and defend that Constitution, this very specific Constitution, the original Constitution, against enemies foreign and domestic, which means that if we don't do that, then I believe that you should lose your citizenship.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, you agree?
I do.
Okay. So I believe that because you're not taking life, liberty, or property from them, you're basically just taking their ability to be able to interface with the government that has jurisdiction over the land of all people here, right? Over all of their citizens and their inhabitants, legal inhabitants, right? Because those who are invaders are not legal inhabitants. They have no business here, and they need to be removed. And that's why the Constitution was written the way it was, to ensure that they would be removed. So we're not even abiding by that. But when we look at these protesters and people that are out literally protesting against, they're protesting for matters that are absolutely unconstitutional.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so when we look at that and we go, you know what? We've covered this in the ratification debates, and I don't know if you remember this, Tammy, but it was Grayson that was asking, he wanted to know how the militia would not be satisfactory, or the posse, the sheriff's posse, would be satisfactory in, you know, enforcing the laws of, you know, of the county. And Madison came back, mm-hmm. and he used rioting, you know, and or protesting as a perfect example that would require the state to send more forces to basically quell the civil unrest. Civil unrest was not acceptable in this Republican form of government.
Right.
Which is one of the reasons why they made sure that we had a mechanism of standing up to our government, which is the right of petition, to petition for the redress of grievances, to go into our representatives and say, I've got a problem with you. You have no business being out blocking commerce in, you know, on the roadways or on the sidewalks, anywhere. If you don't like what's going on, you get your butt down on a table with a piece of paper, you write out your constitutional argument on how your rights are being, you know, stepped on, and then you get your butt in front of your representatives down in your county city hall, or, you know, if you got city representatives, and start there. But you need to start local and say, my rights are being trampled on. That is the civil process in America. And so we have found there's this history that they found out. And I remember learning about this even before 2020. But it became a standard operation where many of these people, these protesters, were being paid, and expenses were being paid for them to travel around the country to gear up and ratchet up the level of protest to make sure damage was being occurred.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I believe that if you get arrested at a protest and you basically say, you do this again, you're going to lose your citizenship. Because the Constitution demands that you be civil. You don't like something?
Yeah.
Then you got to get into your city government, and you need to provide a petition for actually articulating an argument of why what they're doing is unconstitutional. Because these guys couldn't shine the light of day on things that were unconstitutional. They're only pointing to the wanting unconstitutional government. They want the handouts. They want, you know, socialism. They want communism. They want it now. These are insurrections.
Yeah, and you're talking about the protests where people do harm to property and people, not just protests.
Yes, well, I believe that all protests need to end out in the public forum. The court had no ability to actually tell you that you have a right to deny somebody their right of commerce. If you're blocking the walkway, and I'm just trying to walk to, you know, I'm coming back from lunch and I'm going back to my job or going back to my business, and I can't get there because they're blocking me. I am being denied my right to conduct business because these people want to actually deny me of this, because that's what they're doing deliberately. They're denying access.
Mm-hmm.
This goes back, because let's look at this in history. There was the civil rights problems, right? Obviously, there was this civil unrest and civil disobedience where people would go into the businesses and shut them down. You know, there'd just be a lot of blacks that would go into a restaurant and basically shut down the operations because they wouldn't leave. And it required them to be arrested and pulled out. These were peaceful protests. They felt that that was the only way that they could get the nation's attention. Now, right, wrong, or indifferent, that was because, and it was right about that time, when the courts actually started ruling in favor of that. Now,
I got a question on that before we go any further.
Yeah, go ahead.
If there, it was a whites only, let's say just for example, it's a whites only establishment, and the people would go in there and they would be forced to be trespassed and then they would be arrested. Okay. Is that the same thing as being in the streets with signs and yelling and blocking the road? Because the business has a business license. They have public access. They're a public access facility. But they're discriminating in violation of the Constitution. And the people were being arrested for trespassing, not for protesting. Because the owner says they're trespassing because this is whites only. Well, and that's a violation of the Constitution. I think that example is more nuanced than what we have going on with these Antifa and BLM.
Okay, so this is when the beginning of the judges said that your First Amendment right to protest something like that right. going on, you have that mm-hmm. right. In other words, they basically made it so that you could protest anything and everything, and you could demand communism now. You could go out into the streets and literally run an insurrection against the Constitution, because we've seen that with actually the Communist Party, and we've seen that with Nazis and so forth. They go out and they do their march or what have you, and they're literally demanding a fundamental undoing of our Republican form of government.
Right.
Now, do you have a right to actually go out and a proselyte an ideology? Yeah, you kind of do. And if you go and create a parade like the Nazis do, then you're abiding by the laws. But if you start taking action to actually try to coerce or try to, you know, impact or influence government or people in government or the vote, you know, any way that you start taking it beyond, you know, we believe in this. But as far as I'm concerned, the day you shift from basically an academic view of, you know, keeping it ideologically and moving it into active politicalism or activism, grassroots activism to invoke literal laws and changes like Sharia law, what have you, then you've stepped across that line as a U.S. citizen. And now you're actually attacking the Constitution. Now, when you're talking about white businesses only allowing white people, you're absolutely right. They were violating the Constitution. But most of these, see, if you're a club where everybody pays and you're not an open business, then you can deny anybody that you want. If you want to be a white club, a black club, because believe it or not, they have them.
Yeah. Oh, I know.
And, but if you're open
to... That's a private club, not public access.
Right. And if you're open to the public, so it's public access, then you can't create, you know, differentiations between where different demographics are to sit. Men sit here, women sit there. Whites sit here, blacks sit there, Asians sit there. Whatever, when you start, you know, breaking down the demographics of requiring a differentiation where you're playing the game of separate but equal, then you're denying people their right to be able to sit where they want in a, because once you've opened a public business, that means that the public, anybody in the public has a right there to come and create a transaction with you. and you can't treat them differently. This is why equal protection under the law, under the 14th Amendment, was to be applied, to ensure that businesses couldn't create these types of nuances in their rules or policies to say, you can't be, served here, you got to be over there. You can't ride the bus here, you have to be back there. This is where governments and all these people, or I should say all these different businesses and organizations and so forth, started going down the path of playing the Jim Crow laws, and they were absolutely unconstitutional. So when you're petitioning and petitioning and petitioning and nothing else is helping, then unfortunately, then I think civil unrest might be necessary. I would never tell people to do it. I would constantly try to do the right thing. But I can understand where it seemed like, and it wasn't like America was actually had deaf ears. When you really look at the civil rights movement, the same thing with the abolition movement. The only way the abolition movement ever took traction wasn't because of the blacks. It was because of the whites. The whites actually started getting rid of slavery before the Constitution. They wanted to get rid of slavery, period. Except the evil sides of politics and people and so forth needed to have a way to divide us. And the more ways they can divide us, the more they can control us. And that's all it's been. It's all been about putting more and more divisive things. They divide us over our sex. They divide us over our religion. I mean, anything and everything's game on the table to dividing and conquering. So, back to these protests. I believe that if you're out there in the city streets and you're protesting, it's one thing to shut down a business, and to go in and shut down a business. But when you're denying everybody in that community to being able to conduct commerce, then you're taking the rights away from the community. It's one thing to strike a business, like let's just say there's a business that, is got really bad practices overseas where they're, they've got kids chained to the machinery. They're just really evil companies that are operating. Then go inside the company and use civil unrest that way. But don't be out in the streets trying to take it to that level. Because as far as I'm concerned, when you start denying a person their rights, then you've crossed the line and you're now guilty of violating the Constitution. What we want to do is we want to encourage people to use the Constitution and to use civil discourse in petitioning their government and forcing their legislative government, their Republican form of government, to solve these problems by correcting the laws or creating the necessary laws so that we can have the appropriate, so we can all equally be protected by the law and equally be, free to succeed under the law. Any other points? Any other? Because what I'd like to see
is on that topic.
Yeah, I'd like to see citizenship revoked. You go from one protest, you get arrested from one protest, and you go to another one. That doesn't mean that you're just a person that wants to attack the Constitution. So I know we need to kind of look at this, but there's no doubt in my mind that the money behind all of this and everything that's driving this is anti-Constitution, anti-America, and they're trying to basically create the division and fear and those types of things. I'm sorry, you said something. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say it's subversion.
Yes.
And,
yes.
I read when we were in the last show, we were talking about Teddy Roosevelt in that era and how they shut down the Senate. Uh-huh. They shut down petition. No, it wasn't Roosevelt. It was Van Buren.
Van Buren, yeah.
They shut down the petitions to the Senate over abolition.
Yes.
How can they shut down a constitutionally protected right that's laid out the First Amendment? How did he do that?
Ah, so this is the chicken and the egg. This is where these guys realized that the petition was asking them to do something that would have been unconstitutional. The Constitution protected states' rights of choice, of being slave states or not, right? Mm-hmm. Ah, so...
I don't know about that.
Well, so this the Constitution...
I mean, it depends on what you're talking about. I mean, how can you have a law or... how can you have a law that doesn't go along with the law of nature? I mean, in common law.
So this goes to, you know, the insidiousness of how everything progressed. So there was a compromise in the Constitution that they were going to allow states to maintain slavery and the importation of slaves up until 1808. Well, so everything went to plan. And as everything was playing out, the South realized that there were going to be states that were going to be joining the Union that would have nothing to do with slavery. And they actually looked at the real estate, and they looked at where they were, and they saw their investments in Missouri were going to go south. In other words, they weren't. Missouri was not going to be a slave state. There was more money and the amount of affluence that was protecting Missouri's slavehood in going into the Union as a slave state. That's what made it happen, was the money. And it was the money from the other states that influenced Congress to create an unconstitutional ruling called the Missouri Compromise, where the federal government took it upon themselves to inflict slavery upon all states below the Mason-Dixon line. Look at Missouri. Missouri happens to be a state above that. If you look at Missouri, it is, if you look at that Mason-Dixon line as it goes across the United States, that latitude, Missouri actually sits on top of that line. And so what they did was they said, we're going to bring Missouri in as a slave state, and all states below the Mason-Dixon line will be slave states. They had no authority to do any of that. None of it. And so that right there actually opened the door for all of these people with the abolition movement to say, hey, you're not following the Constitution by doing that. So they basically said, well, we don't care about, you know, those violations. We're not going to do your bidding because slavery is granted in the Constitution. And that was their position, because technically what should have been happening should have been an amendment process. The northern states actually should have changed their tune instead of talking about moral issues. You hear me say this all the time. When you deal with things at a moral level, you lose the battle every time. But if you look at things as a constitutional issue and whether these things are right for government to inflict upon people or not, and based on the original design of the Constitution, all these things were unconstitutional, as well as maintaining slavery. And so the northern states were actually gaining. If they actually took back and made those states that joined as slave states and said, you're no longer slave states. You're no longer slave states. If you want to be a slave state, then the people have to choose that. But you're not going to be considered and being forced to be a slave state. We had no authority to do that. Had they gone down that path of actually doing the right thing, and they petitioned them to actually do the right thing, but the problem was it was always an issue of right and wrong instead of constitutional, having the authority and not having the authority, and saying, you got to fix this because you didn't have the authority to do that. Now there's no wiggle room. You've actually pointed out that what they did was wrong. That makes sense, right?
Yeah, I understand what you're talking about. But I think that they should have had more volition or to deal with that when they wrote the Constitution. I mean, and I'm looking at it in hindsight, of course.
Yeah, so.
And there's all kinds of things that have to go along with it. I mean, you know, they weren't going to be able, we might not have been able to win the revolution without the southern states, and they might not have gone along with this. That could have been an issue that could have kept the country from ever being founded. Well, they wouldn't have been an issue at that time. So yes, they kind of put it to the side in order to do what they had.
Yeah, so next year, Sean, next year, when we actually go through the Constitutional Convention, you're going to see those arguments going back and forth of why these men, they all felt that the keeping the Union intact was more important. It was the most important thing. And when the three states, right, when Georgia and the two Carolinas said, we're leaving the Union because we have to have slavery. When right, they did that, then that was it. That basically, you know, put the Constitution on a sideways path.
Right.
And until that
plus,
got
didn't
fixed.
It have to be phased out by 1808 anyways?
Well, that was the slave trade. So they had to phase out the slave trade.
Importing slaves.
Yeah, that was the importation of slaves. And so, and actually, most people said, well, that's not big. That's not a big deal. Don't tell me it's not a big deal, because look, when they actually shut down the slave trade, the states joining the Union were far less slave-oriented after that. In other words, now they couldn't just bring in a whole bunch of slaves to throw into the new state and let slavery start growing. So by the time Missouri got there, the only slaves that existed in Missouri were on the franchise plantations.
Could they transport them across state lines?
Yeah, they could. Yes, they could. But when you take slaves away from states, you know, outside of the growth rate, the United States was growing pretty rapidly, and the slaves were not, let's just say, they weren't cooperating in procreating enough, and so they couldn't maintain the growth of the slave trade, or I should say the growth of slave labor in the growth of the slave families. Does that make sense? That's why they wanted to import and import and import. And for 20 years, they were able to go across the southern or the northern, the Gulf Coast states, Alabama, Mississippi, Florida, and so forth. So the Gulf Coast states were able to, you know, maintain slavery and get into the Union. But after 1808, what state joined the Union? Mississippi joined the Union afterwards. And it was a slave state because it was already nurtured. All the other states, Arkansas and the rest of them, they weren't developed, and Missouri was just being nurtured. So I look at it this way, that everything was really going to work out. That slave compromise was going to work out where the nation would eventually expunge slavery from its states and from the books, period. They were going to do it without a civil war. But when the Missouri Compromise came out, it guaranteed the course of this nation would be straddled with slavery until its death or civil war. One of those two. So, to me, and we just ran out of time. So that kind of, we covered the Eighth Amendment. Now we got to cover the Ninth Amendment. And then we'll cover the Tenth Amendment and go on from there. So I always love the conversations, and as more importantly, I love the questions. Folks, I hope that as we go through all this stuff, I know a lot of this stuff is repeated, but if you're hearing things that I've said and I've said and I've said for the first time, then I just invite you to listen to all of the podcasts on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic. We need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the republic review model on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email.
Thank you.